Welcome to Polycast, a Civilization podcast focused on game strategy.
Dan Q.
Makalua.
The Mean Team.
QNL.
With guest co-hosts.
Richard
Zian Wolf.
You know what? Next time somebody asks me for my number, I'll give them the Polycast number so they can leave a message on it.
Welcome to episode 135. I'm Dan Q. Did you know that 7 days without laughter makes one week? W-E-A-K. I know I had to explain it. Also joined by Makalua.
Dan, your punning is weak.
Thank you for acknowledging my punning. Also joined by the main team.
Greetings, fellow World Conquest conspirators.
Lisa, Q&L.
What's the third one? I forgot. Was it Modcast? Oh, I don't remember. Oops.
I see what you're doing. I see what you're doing. I get it.
Don't worry, listener. She always greets us this way.
Joined by return guest co-host and former regular co-host, Wedger Locutus.
Hello, everyone.
And first-time guest co-host, but not a stranger to podcasting for some unknown reason, Jacob Zian Wolf Turner.
Happy to be here, I guess.
Uh-oh. That's not promising.
There's been an announcement from Valve that Steam has been hacked. They recommend that you change your password. This affects everyone that has signed up for Civilization V or anybody that plays Steam. According to the email from Gabe, he says that we learned that intruders obtained access to the Steam database. And in addition to the forums, this database contained information including usernames, hashed and salted passwords. I don't know what that means.
Salting a password makes it really hard for them to just set up a computer that'll go, did you use dog, cat, whale, fish?
Oh, okay.
All the standard people like to use these password things. It's called a library attack, and that's a really quick way to get passwords normally. Salting makes it sort of complicated how the password is actually input into the system so that there's 20 million different ways that you can enter cat. You yourself would just type cat and hit enter. But the way that it accepts that is any one of numerous different ones. So it really slows down the ability of a hacker to decrypt your password or to guess it.
Well, I'm glad I guess my password is less compromised than I previously thought and also less breakfasty. Game purchases, email addresses, billing addresses, and encrypted credit card information. So, yay. Yeah, they're still investigating, so you should probably watch out for any fraudulent activity on your credit cards. And, this sucks. So, it kind of brings to mind what some people were seeing earlier this year. It wasn't this year. It was last year that Zip5 came out. last year that, moving to a platform such as Steam could, moving to a digital platform for sale of Civ 5 could expose a bunch of people to security risks and may have happened. I don't know. I mean, I guess things have come to pass and, I'm definitely not happy about this and I don't really know anyone who is. But in any case, it's a friendly reminder to just change your password every once in a while, namely, like, now.
Like, as she's talking, I'm doing it.
Yeah, of course, we've talked about Steam in the past, digital distribution, digital rights management, multiplayer and communications platform. Woo! Thank you, Wikipedia. There are over 1,400 games available on Steam and 35 million active user accounts. And, of course, Civilization V is one of those games. The data that they gained access to, so in other words, they have the data, or at least they had access to the data, but because the information is encrypted, they're going to have to decrypt it in order for it to be of any use, combined with the fact that, and it's a bit misleading on Wired.com, where it says hackers access Steam users' encrypted passwords and credit cards, what they gained access to were forum account passwords, which, while they're separate from, you know, your Steam account passwords that you would use to purchase games, for example, it is on the same server, and Valve is being upfront about what has happened and their recommendation. Although they're not forcing people to change their passwords, it is a good idea, even if you just use your password for Steam. But if you're one of those individuals that uses your password for multiple accounts as well, it's probably a good idea, just like it's a good idea to be on the safe side to monitor your credit card activity, as you should be doing anyway, and as Lisa also said, to be changing your password on a regular basis. There's also the ability with Steam, something called Steam Guard, which I do have activated. And what happens is that the first time you try to log into your account on a computer, that Steam, you know, checks your IP address and says, you've never been on this computer before, will send you an alphanumeric code to the email address on profile for your Steam account that you then need to input into the Steam client in order for that computer, i.e., your computer that's online, its IP address, in order to actually be able to access your Steam account as another security measure, but only if you are using it, but it is relatively simple to use, and you see it on the standard Steam interface.
And I guess while we're talking about standard password security and whatnot, also remember that a secure password isn't necessarily just the, I have a capital, I have a special character. The really important thing nowadays is that your password is long. It can be the easiest thing in the world to guess, but as long as it's long, it's going to be hard for someone who doesn't actually know you to get into. So you can use, like, the names of your three children or something like that, because most attacks are from people who are doing massive attacks across numerous passwords. So they're just running something that's going through and saying, is it A, is it B, is it C, is it AA, is it AB, is it AC, all the way up to however long it needs to go, and doing up to, like, 6 or 7 characters, they can guess whatever they want to, and it'll take them 1 or 2 days. But doing something that's 16 characters long, they're not going to get through that for 10 years.
And if they do manage to get through that after that length of time, and they do actually get your credit card information, credit card will have expired in the sense that you now have a new expiry date, month, and year. Plus the fact, more and more credit cards, of course, are coming also with the chip technology, so there's a PIN number that you then have to use in addition to your credit card number and your expiry date. Admittedly, it also depends on the merchants that you're dealing with, because some of them have not quite gotten to the point of using that yet. But as time goes on, more and more are going to do that, because businesses will recognize, hey, it's probably a good idea to include this because our customers will feel more secure about using their credit card to purchase our services. And if we don't, then they're going to start going to another service. There is inevitably comparisons, of course, to the Sony network hacking issue. combination of the fact about how primarily that Sony wasn't being upfront with what happened as quickly as Valve was. Did like some of the comments here, you know, like, well, this just sucks at Wired. And it does, but I think it's just a reminder that, yes, it is important for, as Jacob was talking about, to have your password be long.
So I was looking at who's responsible for this, and I was basically I was reading a report from Joystick that said that the group is apparently called owned. And, well, I don't know, maybe you should bleep that out so that you don't give them more advertising. But apparently they've been enabling cheating and Steam games with unauthorized code, and they hacked the Steam user form to insert an ad for its own site. And some users, so basically the advertisement for their site was displayed on the Steam user forums, and also sent as an email from Steam. Not from Steam, from FKN owned via. And because of that, Valve has taken those forums down. And the reason conjectured by Joystick is that they don't want this design collective to advertise themselves, which I can understand. But I don't know if it doesn't really seem like their objective was to get credit card information, but who knows? I don't know if I don't know what the extent of this is, because, people already knew that the Steam forums were hacked, but I think it's a bigger deal that now that, that Steam itself has.
I think the real test is, going to be further responses, from Valve, perhaps further communication about what steps they have taken to determine exactly how this unauthorized access to their network was taken, and then without describing in too much detail what they did to resolve it, because of course sometimes you give too much information, then they told us exactly how they've increased their security. Now we can be more specific and try to target that. There have been suggestions, for example, some people saying, "Oh, this is why I don't use Steam specifically," or "This is why I just still buy all of my computer games in a store and forget about doing digital distribution in any way." But we're seeing more and more movement towards that, that at the very least there is an online activation component. And, of course, the argument is being, well, I guess if you don't like digital rights management in the future, then not just for games, but maybe other software as well, then either you're not going to use this software, or you're going to have to start pirating the software, which is a whole...
yeah.
That's a whole separate issue.
Yeah, EA's got their own thing now for authentication. Ubisoft also has a thing for authentication. Even if you buy it in the store now, it has to be authenticated online. So avoiding Steam just because of that is just kind of silly.
Steam should just ask Sony for advice. I think that would be the way to go here.
No, I think you mean the other way around.
At least Steam doesn't store their passwords in plain text.
Exactly. They treated the information well, unlike Sony.
Well, see, now I've read conflicting reports about that the passwords were unencrypted when stored on the PS3 itself, but in the central database forgetting the name of the company, Sony, that it was encrypted, but that if someone was able to hack into an individual user's PS3 box, then they would be able to get access to their password in plain text. I mean, even then, that is in itself an issue. It's like, whoa. Although in that case, it could be that people are targeting specific individuals. I mean, like Jacob said before, this was a mass attack. This wasn't targeted at any individual user specifically, but at Valve. And then essentially it's attempting to see who is it we can get access to. Let's go over to the extreme. Let's say that they actually got a hold of your credit card information, which again, doesn't seem to be that was the case here. And they were able to decrypt it, which is also an issue that we've talked about. Okay, it is a credit card. It is not a debit card. I have separate issues with debit cards. We'll really go off on a tangent if we do that. But anyway, if there's a credit charge that you did not authorize, get in contact with your credit card company to report those fraudulent charges. There is that protection. Because if it's the credit card, you're not instantly out that money. It's the next time that the bill comes through and then you've got the due date, which could be, a month from that point in time when you would have to pay it. Especially with the ability to monitor your credit card transactions, either by phone or online, you can be monitoring even before the next statement comes. And I'm going to tell you, that happened to me earlier this year. My credit card information was stolen, but my credit card company phoned me to say, there are some really unusual charges on your credit card here. It happened to be an incredible amount of money. So they alerted me even, and it was within 24 hours. But even if they don't do that, you do some kind of big purchase and you spend thousands of dollars on a credit card, it's going to raise a red flag. But if it's, dozens of dollars a day or hundreds of dollars there, you might be the first person to realize what it is. But contact the credit card company and you let them know what's going on, then it becomes a matter of where they investigate, and if they confirm that, yes, this was a fraudulent charge on your card, then they will go after the individual, and the money will be credited back to you. Not saying that it's not fun, because now you got to get a new credit card and wait for it to arrive and activate it and everything.
It's inconvenient, but monitoring your stuff can really save your butt.
Yes. It's not like they gained access to, like your social insurance number.
Social insurance number? This must be a Canadian thing.
Or a social security number, depending upon where you live, or equivalent.
But by the way, to make one thing clear, the credit card details were stolen and the Steam account stuff was stolen. It's just that Steam believed that the security on them was not cracked yet. So they did get access to the actual Steam database, but they did not manage to break into anyone's account yet. It's a little bit worse than at first seen.
Now, are you sure that they actually know that the credit card information was taken? Because what I was seeing was that the wording on Wired was a little bit, they had the potential to have access to the information, not necessarily, we do know for sure they downloaded this info.
Let's see. Yeah, the wording is really, I mean, they hacked into a database that included information like credit card details. Yeah, and it's a question of, did they actually download that stuff? But they did have access to it. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, the wording is still kind of unclear, because I also got the impression that they didn't even make a copy of the encrypted credit card information, just that they had access to it. But if they realized what they had access to, in addition to form account, if they realized, hey, yes, this is encrypted, but this is credit card information, let's take a copy of that too, they're just going to be on the safe side. All we know for certain, based on their actions, is that they got the Steam forum account information.
Yeah, I mean, they know for a fact that certain Steam forum accounts have actually been compromised, and people have been, like you said, people have been posting stuff that shouldn't have been posted, just different people logging in on other people's names. But they did, literally, Gabe Newell says in a statement, basically, we learned that intruders obtained access to a Steam database in addition to the forums. And this database contained information including usernames, hashed and salted passports, game purchases, email addresses, billing addresses, encrypted credit card information. So they did get access to the actual Steam database, but they don't have evidence that the encrypted credit card numbers or personally identifying information were taken by the intruders. So they're not sure if it was downloaded or that the protection was cracked. So they had access to the database, but if they did anything with that, they don't know. But they know for a fact that they hacked into forums and they broke people's forums accounts.
On CFC, General Sidic Bunny. Okay. He talked about a number of things in response that we've already addressed, and the only thing that he talked about that we haven't raised yet was just briefly that someone had made the argument that there's an increasing amount of data breaches. That may be reality, but it may also just be perception. I mean, the number of people and the number of services that are similar to Steam, and by that I don't just mean digital distribution of games or software, but just services that say, hey, input your credit card information and you now get access to XYZ. In addition to that, he is arguing that it's kind of like with crime, for example. Whenever you talk about crime being up or down, is it less crimes being committed, or is it just that they're not being reported as much? So in this case, perhaps they are being reported more because now companies are seeing the value in being upfront with what has happened rather than trying to cover it up.
Basically, all this has been going on all along, but they haven't been telling you.
Yeah, exactly. Perhaps we can end this serious conversation, definitely for the most part, on some humorous notes. Comment on Wired. I know certain panelists will enjoy this comment in particular. As long as my Skyrim preload has not been affected.
That's right. Stay away from my Skyrim.
Says Buka and Aegea on Wired. And then from Balmont at Cockatoo, what about the parents? Won't someone please think of the parents?
No.
Moving on, why don't I just introduce the next topic, just because I can. Idea for individual currency system, started by Insane Weasel. And yes, I believe your username is quite appropriate for this suggestion. But anyway, what if each ship traded not in gold, but in-game currency that varied from nation to nation? It would allow the player to print money. If they wanted, they could get a massive cash infusion. After a certain number of turns, they would have to pay it back with interest to the computer in the form of X gold per turn. If someone did not want to pay this, that would weaken their currency. A player with weak currency would have to pay more when trading or paying off city-state allies. Someone with a strong currency would be able to trade favorably with weak currency players. I think this would add a nice level of realism, but I worry it may be too complex, quote-unquote. I think Messick has it right where he says it's not so much a question of complexity, it's a question of whether or not it would make the game more fun, quote-unquote. And I must say that even if you were to go from gold to a currency system for an individual nation, it's kind of like, why would you bother doing that? Why not just keep it as gold? So I guess that's why he then suggests about Sips being able to print money and get a massive cash infusion and get into interest, and then if you're a bad creditor, you're having difficulty paying your bills and making trades, and if you're a good creditor, it's the opposite. And I'm just thinking...
You can get foreclosed on.
Your nation has been foreclosed.
Yeah, I mean, seriously, do you guys want to lend money to in-game Greece? And don't we already actually sort of, I mean, okay, we call the unit of money we get from the other civ gold, but it could be anything. It's just a convenient name. I mean, if it was a different game, if it like it was Alpha Centauri, they called everything credits, you know, I mean, it's,
well,
I don't know.
Looking for realism?
Yeah. And what's our argument?
You got to look at, I mean, the reason if you print a lot of money, its value goes down isn't because we're failing to pay back some universal money marketeur in the world.
No, we're devaluing our own currency.
Well, our currency is backed by a resource. So really, what he's asking for, if he wants to go for a realism in cash exchange, would be to be able to fractionally trade your resources to other players and to actually have your trades always be resource only. So that would just move away from using currency for units at all to actually having to use specific resources and go get those resources from other players. So that would mean every single time that you know, upgrade a club using ancient warrior to a modern swordsman, then you need to go off and get some iron from someone somewhere that actually physically has an iron resource, which we've sort of got that now, but we do that for absolutely every single unit, making it to where if the only resource you have is gold, then you trade out some of your gold for it. So I think it would just be better to get rid of currency altogether if you wanted to go with that approach and then make it to where doing upgrades and whatever is done directly through resources. But I don't think that would be enjoyable.
But it would make the civic, global currency from the UN, not civic, vote for global currency in the UN a little bit more interesting. I mean, I don't know. Then you get into complications like, you know, what currency does everyone use? I mean, it would be fun to personalize the game a little bit, but it would be, I mean, what if differences had like different currency valuations, you know? Would it make it too much like real life? I don't know if I want to deal with it.
Well, yeah, and of course you're talking about the global currency that we found with the United Nations in Civilization IV. Even in Civ 4 or in Civ 5, the United Nations comes so late anyway, as we often talk about things that go on in the late game, unless you had a later game start, how much of an impact would that even really have, good or bad?
As Phil just pointed out, there is no vote for the UN in Civ 5.
Well, actually, Phil pointed it out in the chat, but I'm the one that said it out loud, so the credit really should go to me.
Oh, okay.
What are you, Bill Gates? Come on now. I know they bought Skype and all, but still. Looking at this, it's almost more of an introduction of a banking system, sort of, than a true currency exchange system. It's just, by the looks, he's suggesting that everyone would start off with the same quote-unquote strength of currency. But the only way that I'm seeing that would make your currency change at all is if you fail to meet your obligations in terms of payback. But it looks like you're just getting upfront gold here in exchange for having to eventually pay out more later. There's so many ways to come up with that in the game already that using this method would be one of desperation at best, I would imagine, because you could just sell luxury resources or whatever. And I don't know, it certainly doesn't fit the currency model of any real system that I'm aware of, but I don't know that it would add much to gameplay either, especially if you start talking about what Wilder was speaking about with the trading for basically every resource you need. That just gets to the level of tedious. And if there's no like strategic choice in acquiring the said resource, you're just having to go through extra clicks to get it, then no, it's not going to be fun. There needs to be some, you know, fruitful decision making or something going on there that adds to strategy in the game, or it's worthless.
I'm already starting to think about how this actually could be abused in gameplay, specifically within Civilization V. Now I think about, hey, I see you've got lots of gold over there, and you're not using it, and we know how the AI in Civ 5 loves to just hoard gold. Hey, can you give me a loan of, like, say, you know, your 2,000 or 3,000 gold? Okay, thanks. And then I turn around and just buy a whole bunch of units and say, ooh, I don't have to pay back my debt. There's nobody to collect anymore.
Well, he did say that you're borrowing directly from the computer, and I don't think he meant another player. I think he just meant there's some game system from which you get your cash infusion. And in that case, though, it's still massively abusable because there's lots of points in Civ where the first one to do it gets a gigantic advantage. So you would just get up to the verge of one of those, go, give me gold! Okay, now I got the advantage. Yeah, I can pay that back. Sure, with interest, whatever. I'm winning.
I see. So you could tank your currency's rating against everybody else's, but if you win the game then and there, it wouldn't matter. That's like just the kind of mechanic for Exodus has never gotten their AI.
Oh, look, I have all the techs for Space Race, so let's rush the entire ship. Oh, but look, my currency is worth nothing, but hey, we're off the planet.
Or military units, for that matter. That's what I'm thinking. Get to a specific military tech and like, oh, look, I have an army now. Like 3 turns after making it there.
My trading with you is going to be horrible, but we're at war, so I don't need to trade.
What's this trading you speak of?
I mean, if your currency were devalued, then presumably it would increase your your exports, and vice versa. If your currency went increased in value, then it would increase imports. I don't know.
It would, but you'd have to model an actual import-export system into the game first, because Civ 5 doesn't use foreign trade routes. So you had nothing to attach that to.
Yeah, if we were going to introduce this, it's not just a matter of, hey, let's replace gold with individual nation currency, and then even the other suggestions that he's talking about. The whole economic model needs to change in order for it to not be so open to abuse, and also, I can't believe I'm going to say this, actually give the AI a fighting chance, like some sort of system that the AI could also use meaningfully. I know we have issues with that right now, but it's kind of like we have enough issues with the systems that are already in place, and this just seems more complicated potentially for the human player. So if it's more complicated for the human player to use properly, what about the AI? Oh, dear.
Yeah, I was trying to teach the AI to use this.
Yeah, get the AI to take some of these. A couple of these deals, you get thousands of gold.
What will happen is every time they go into debt, they will try to take out another loan, and they'll tank their economy.
Yeah, you can get so much money. It's ridiculous. Because they have to give you more, right, in the trade deal? So you know, they have the value of their currency, so you give them a luxury resource, you get 1,000 gold every time.
I know what we should do. We can avoid this problem of having to teach the AI of doing anything if we implement this as part of a multiplayer-only Civ game. Hello, Civilization World? Yeah, we've got an idea for your economic system. Yeah?
I don't like it in multiplayer either, to be honest. Because what will happen is people will do exactly as mentioned earlier by Wouter. They'll just reach something that allows them to screw everyone else over, and if they get there first, then they win, because they'll just take out loans. Well, functionally, that's what this is. It's a loan mechanic. So there's nothing you can really do to stop them then.
Yeah, but that's realistic. Oh, wait, never mind. Oh, wait, this is gameplay. Right.
yes, gameplay. Please don't make too many mechanics where it's an instant loss for everyone else if someone gets there first. And definitely don't raise the occurrences of that. Not that a tech race is a bad thing, but still, balance a little.
So what do we say to insane reason here? And if we were to try to summarize what we've said, plus for thinking about ways to make the economic system more, let's use a generic term, more interesting and engaging, but
minus because you could abuse the heck out of it.
Well, no, wait a minute. That could still be a plus.
Okay, if you're Phil, it's a plus, right?
Apocalypse 1005, the best Civilization 4 one city challenge. Now, of course, this is in the Civ 5 general discussion forum, so he's speaking about Civilization 5. He says he's planning to start a one city challenge game, and was wondering which civilization is the best to choose, which civilization's best in one city challenge run on sentence. I personally think, that's with an X, listeners, India and Darius is actually also not a bad choice. I don't know. What do you guys think for Civ 5?
Gandhi, because it annoys the hell out of Dan.
There you go.
Well, India in particular has the where they feel they can grow larger cities with less unhappiness. If you've got only one city, you want to grow it super huge. So
going against that was that it's really hard for one city to push your happiness cap in Civ 5, since it's a global happiness thing.
Yeah, it depends on how many luxury resources you have close enough to the city that you could hook them up. If you end up in a place with not a lot, then you're going to be, that's going to be a help. And you can also go down tradition, because I forget which one it is, but it gives you less unhappiness in your capital.
I kind of liked one of the ideas in the thread was the Aztecs, and they outline how you can use the early culture boost in battle to really jump ahead in policies, since you've only got the one city, so all your policies are pretty cheap and fast, and you just get so far ahead early on that you steamroll from there.
You need to kill a lot of units, though. I mean, it's, what, 2 culture per kill? I don't see that many. I mean, I guess if you run Raging Barbs, then you could probably go a little crazy. But I usually don't see that many things going on with even the AI on high difficulties. They don't send that many units. Like, you would probably get more just from, like, a strong culture building or something. And unless you just declared war on everybody and ran an always war game as well, but then you slow yourself down from trade perspective. I think Korea is interesting, and definitely Arabia as well, that Krikatona suggested. Yeah, some Siamese, but they lose out some there on the one city.
I don't know if it depends on difficulty level, but I get at least 6 culture per kill if I play with the Aztecs.
So. Yeah, I was going to say, especially if you go up the honor tree, you can get even more.
You can get plus 10.
Yeah, they said.
Yeah, okay.
Barbarians!
And 12 if you have honor. There you go. You're right. So I was mistaken on the 2. I just remembered it being bad, but apparently it's better than I recalled.
Well, and they talk about, you know, you find the barbarians, you don't take the camp for the instant gold gain. They just park 2 of their jaguars there, which have the nice free healing ability, and they just farm it. So whenever a unit shows up, kill it. Yeah, you find a couple of little encampments like that, and you can really be raking it in.
It's pretty impressive. Get some good experience on that, too.
You'd even rotate out the units, so you'd have a lot of really experienced units in case anyone decided to attack you.
And farm even more culture. Mm-hmm. Although, again, I don't see that much from the AI, so you'd probably be relying on barbs for most of the early game, at least. I guess on Immortal and Deity, they'll declare on you, but they don't, like, once you kill them, their follow-up seems slow to me. You kill their initial army. I don't know. I guess my conclusion here is the barbs are better for that tactic.
But certainly the Aztecs, the Arabians you talked about already in passing for the gold. Civ Battle in chat also mentions Persia, Korea. We also mentioned you. So, Persia, Korea, and Babylon. I definitely see Korea for their scientific advantages.
Yeah. Persia's...
I remember there's the increased movement for units during Golden Age.
Yeah, and also the super...
Yeah, it doesn't jump out
a lot longer ones. Headcase mentions that in the thread.
Yeah, Golden Ages are worth more, to me at least, if you have a large empire. So it seems, I mean... It's always useful to have a golden age, but it seems kind of counterproductive to limit Persia to one city on that. Is the more tiles you're working, the more you're getting a benefit on each one, the way I look at it for that. So if you have like 10 cities or one city, you're still getting, you know, the same bonus to each tile you're working, and your raw bonus will be much greater as you go up in city count. They're still good, though.
And I think also at times, if you're also with a one city challenge, not only thinking about just one city challenge for the one city challenge, but also considering what you would like your end victory to be, that could also influence in part your civilization selection. But I also realize that more than that, it's, you know, what you're doing in the game and your social policy selection. So what I actually saw, what is the best civilization for a one city challenge? I actually initially didn't think of, if I was going to do a one city challenge, that my choice of civilization, it's important, but I'd actually be thinking more about, you know, where I end up spawning, you know, my terrain, my neighbors, my social policy selection.
It would definitely alter your social policy selection. And I think in every Civ game I've played, you want a good starting site if you're going to run one city challenge. Could you imagine you have, like, a luxury or two, and that's it? Not the best situation in Civ 5. It would be so hard to get research agreements. Unless you took out loans for cash.
I also could see, even in a one-city challenge, allying you, and still with Civ 5, we're going to get to Civ 4 momentarily here, but in Civilization 5, also allying yourself with city-states, which could then also influence your social policy selection as well. So let's see, civilizations that have a favorable disposition towards city-states. Greece comes to mind for some reason. I don't know.
Siamese, too.
Yeah, they can be to a certain extent your quote-unquote puppets. As compared to having, you know, formal puppets also, in quotes, within your empire, since you are only limited to direct control of one city.
It's hard to protect them unless they're fairly close, though. I mean, I guess you could just give them units, but I don't trust the AI to use units very well.
Usually the city-states,
I don't know about you guys.
Own defense is pretty strong.
Usually. Although I've seen, like, continents get taken over by Genghis Khan or, well, even Alex, strangely, like, going killing them. And it's just the entire thing is Greek or Mongolian.
Yeah, one problem with relying on the city-states is definitely the whole defending them, because you've got one city, so building up and maintaining a strong military is going to be really hard. So defending them is going to be incredibly difficult. And if you fail to defend them, normally what you do is you go capture the city back and then liberate it again. So you've got your city-state buddy again. But in one city challenge, as soon as you capture it, it's razed. You don't get the option to re-liberate it. So that city-state's just gone as soon as anyone manages to take it.
So towards Phil, what also is getting at, you want the city-state to be close to you and or have already scouted out the city-state and see, you know, where it's situated, who it's near, what type of city-state it is, how many units it has, the type of units it has, and then deciding, in other words, I ally myself with it. You're right. Essentially, it's you're fending for yourself, buddy, or buddette. I don't want to be sexist here.
Buddette.
I don't think cities hold too much in terms of gender anyway, so I think it could work regardless. No, it's a male city. And I don't know how you would determine that, and I don't want to.
But good luck, man, with population growth.
It's like just Zelda Division. They're amoeba cities. Oh, no, that's the AI, my bad.
So what about and I don't have a specific thread for this. I'm sure it exists out there, but I thought this is a question that is just as equally valid to discuss and just as equally possible in Civilization 4. What is the best civilization for a one-city challenge there?
Yes, this thread definitely exists. I remember reading about it like 2 years ago or something, or maybe even, I don't know, it's around that time anyway. It's been a while since this thread has cropped up in Civ 4, but it's definitely been around. One of the worst are obviously the Ethiopians, because they don't have anything that really is benefited by owning a single city. The traits don't work. You know, creative and organized isn't really doing anything for one city. You're going to get a border pop anyway, so you don't really need creative. And then his unique building just gives you more culture, which you can't win that victory condition without permanent alliances. So that's not very helpful. And the Oromo, you're really not going to cover much ground with those in OSDC either. So that's worst. But what about best? I would say if you're using restricted leaders, you might want an industrious leader to pick up wonders. Or alternatively, you could go to the straight specialist and cottage route, like if you're doing something like Elizabeth of England, for example. A lot of the best Hall of Fame games in One City Challenge by Misotu use Elizabeth. And I'm not sure if Misotu cottages that or just takes advantage of financial leader or how that's working, because I mean, we're seeing UN wins on deity in the 1100 AD to 1400 AD range from One City Challenge. So I think traits actually matter more than the civilization for the most part, although both thread and the hypothetical thread are asking for civilization in this context. I think that certainly you want industrious, philosophical, or financial for this, because things like organized, you don't have that much maintenance, you don't need courthouses in particular. Something like expansive, yeah, it's great, but you're only building one granary and you only need like one or two workers. So again, that's not going to help you nearly as much as it normally would. Normally, expansive is top tier. I see you can go through the list, imperialistic, aggressive, all that kind of thing. You're going to be limited in one city challenge with war for the most part. So it's hard to get as much use out of those traits. So you pick something with those top three traits, and then maybe you can try to sneak in a good unique building. I don't know what would count in this case. Certainly with unrestricted, you could do more interesting things than with restricted on in terms of one city challenge.
In the chat, Bantams, we already mentioned Elizabeth. Bantams also mentions Korea.
Seoan's not bad by any stretch, but you got protective there, which isn't helping you a lot. And if you're running financial, you're either working cottages or you're working coast tiles or, I don't know, maybe Riverside Windmills or something. That's a much later game. I'm not sold on Korea. I think their opening's a little too slow. And I'm not so sure how good the cottages are long term.
Well, yeah, the starting techs for Korea are not that strong for a 1C challenge. I mean, it's good that they do start with mining, but mysticism doesn't really help Korea very much. I wouldn't say that any protective sit would be particularly strong for a 1C challenge. I would go for any leader with the traits, you know, industrial, financial, or philosophical, or any combination. I'm trying to think. Yeah, most of the civs that will help you grow out, such as, like, charismatic, for example, like, I can't see that helping that much. Especially since one of the strengths is that you get plus one happiness for each city. If you have just one, it dilutes it.
Yeah, I mean, you can get +2 from that, and that's nice early, but that's about all you're getting other than unit experience, which, again, you might find some use in that, especially if you have permanent alliances on. But unless you're doing, like, Marathon or you're doing some kind of challenge variant play, war bonuses are only so-so in one city challenge. You're probably not going to get very far, especially on the faster game speed. You're not going to get very far. But +2 happiness is nice until you can get it at the Globe Theater. Currently, one of the Hall of Fame Challenger games is running a one-city challenge, and they are saying to skip the Globe Theater early and trade for drama instead of attacking there directly. Essentially, they have you going down the liberalism path as quickly as possible. Now, some of that is to get a permanent alliance since they're allowed in that game, but yeah, take advantage of bureaucracy as soon as you can, because it is easily your best civic in that tree. And then, obviously, late game, you can defy whatever UN resolution you want. you're going to have Globe by then. And, no matter how much unhappiness that would cause, you're just getting eliminated all. So that works.
Yeah, I think Phil wants to introduce this topic because it's near and dear to his heart.
Oh, man. This, you know, he's got a troll face on their face just looking at the title of this thread. Started by ESOS, it's spelled ESOES, but the two E's are capitalized, so it might be ESOES as well. Anyway, S-O-S. The thread is titled, there you go, thank you, SOS. That makes a lot more sense. Sorry, I didn't see it right away. Maybe if he capped the first S as well. Oh well. Anyway, nukes unfair is the thread title, with a comma in between the nukes and unfair, and a question mark after unfair. I hate to QQ, man, something you see a lot more in StarCraft 2, I assure you. My first time hitting modern era in a deity game. Been warring Rome since, like, turn 20, and they refused to give any peace all game. He's been nuked 5 times by Rome. His capital's been hit for about 14 pop total, the 3 of my puppets, using a word that I would probably not like to say on the air, and yada yada. Basically, he is saying that implementing some mechanics to the game as countermeasures to nukes would be healthy. In other words, he wants a counter to nukes. And that just makes me frown. Nukes shouldn't have a counter. Are you kidding me? Nukes should answer everything. Go, go, nukes. And this is actually a poll attached to this, which is probably why our esteemed main co-host chose it. And the poll options are, yes, you should be able to combat the AI spam, or no, it's fair the way it is. I don't mind losing huge amounts of pop and being defenseless against it.
There's really nothing subjective in this poll.
I was going to say,
this poll is biased.
This goes against my market research training, listeners. I can't quite put my finger on why that is.
Maybe it's the no answer.
Poll options leading just a little bit. Phrase it's just a bit. There's no bias.
Yeah, just a smidge. I have mixed opinions on this.
There is a defense, though, and it comes up in the thread. The expression, you know, that an ounce of prevention is better than a pound of cure. Take away their uranium. Going to the next topic, right? Oh, we want to talk about this more? Oh, okay.
And it's true. It is one of those things where once somebody gets there, if they have an intention to screw everyone else in the world over, they can. And it has always been that way as long as I've played Civ. I don't think I've ever played a game of Civ where nukes were not just utterly capable of ruining you. Now, you had SDI in Civ 4, or you had some kind of umbrella defense in Civ 2 or whatever.
Civ 4 also had the bomb shelter.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, but that didn't really do enough. Like, that would reduce the damage a nuke did, but if you took, like, two or three nukes, and tactical nukes were not that expensive, you were still hosed. And, yeah, like, an infantry versus tactical nuke, tactical nuke costs about 2.5 infantry. So if there's more than, like, 8 or 9 units in the city, then you just nuke it. And frequently that is the case. And you could, of course, obliterate a stack with a nuke easily, so no one can attack you if you have nukes. And there's nothing that they could do with that stack, because bomb shelters don't apply outside of the cities. So even two nukes would completely eliminate, you know, even the mightiest Shaka stack of like 100 deity cavalry instantly. And, you know, so if I would argue it's actually harder to kill everything at once, because they don't put it all in one tile slash hex.
But, yeah, you have to hope they're all clustered so you can just hit them.
Yeah. And you can probably get some good returns from that. It's a better way to spend uranium than a GDR, that's for sure.
But is it as fun as a GDR?
What? Are you saying that nuking something isn't fun?
I don't know. Nukes versus giant death robots. I like the giant death robots.
Way. This is Japan. What are you talking about?
I'm with Mackie on this one. It's not just because it's Mackie that's saying it. I actually do. But anyway.
Yeah, they're fun, but nukes are more efficient.
So let's say you find yourself, like the situation is talking about, that the AI has nukes and you do not. Okay, so your objective should now be, since you weren't able to prevent them from getting uranium in the first place, is to stop them from being able to build any more. So hopefully you have, you're comparable in tech still, that you're able to go and target either the city-states that their friends are allied with or the cities within their empire that have access to uranium. Focus on that. Maybe there will be some retaliation with whatever, you know, atomic weapons they've already been able to build, you know, the atomic bomb, nuclear missile, one or the other. But you'll stop them from being able to do that in the future. And then, since they were throwing around the nukes, either they built the Manhattan Project or somebody else built the Manhattan Project, and everybody can build nuclear weapons, now you could have access to those, to that resource if you wanted, and you could turn around and finish the technology to be able to start investing in atomic bombs and nuclear missiles yourself.
And that Manhattan Project, by the way, is like a beacon that you need to stop this right now. And it's not something that's very subtle. I think, I don't know, maybe you should stop their uranium at the moment. Or another thing you could do is bribe them to war against another Civ. They'll fire the nukes, then you declare on them and pillage their uranium, and they can't build any more nukes. Nukes are fairly expensive, so once they launch them, you should have at least a few turns to go on a pillaging spree. So unless that AI is absolutely massive and has like 8 sources of uranium or something, you can probably prevent too much direct nuke damage. At least that's the hope.
Or it's a situation where it's like, well, yeah, I like to be able to go and take their uranium from them, from their city-states or their civs proper that they have in their control, whether they built them, they're puppeted, they're annexed, whatever. Then start looking around the map for city-states. You can even try to take the city-states from them, especially if that's their only source of uranium. I've seen that in a number of games where actually, how come the city-states has all the uranium? None of the civs proper have it. What's going on here? That and allying yourself with perhaps a city-state that isn't already allied with someone, because if you're able to get with someone who wasn't already allied, it's going to cost you less gold in order to be able to get that ally. So then at the very least, you've leveled the playing field, at least somewhat, as far as nuclear weapons itself goes.
You could just nuke them back.
Yeah, if you're there.
Rather nuke them first.
Yeah,
yeah, that's right. Much more preferable. It's hard to hold on to uranium tiles when they keep getting nuked. That's certainly true.
Newest, youngest leading civilization fan site, known as We Play Civ or WePlayCiv.com. And one of the individuals on this call might actually know something about it. I don't know, seeing as how he co-founded it, and he's an administrator, and yeah.
I didn't know CM Wolf worked for Wee Blizzard, so I guess the biggest thing for us was that Dale, one of the co-founders, retired just, I guess, a month or two ago. So it's just over me now. And yeah, we're now basically very actively recruiting other people to help us out. And it brings a lot of new blood and a lot of new energy to the staff. And they're coming up with all sorts of cool new ideas that I think will go public very shortly if they haven't already.
I don't know. It seems like Weekly Civ has grown quite a lot since it first came out. I've noticed some changes in the forum, I guess format itself. I also did notice that there is like a donation bar, and people have been like regularly making donations every month, to WePlayCiv. So as a result, it seems to be doing well. I mean, very little downtime. I don't think I've ever seen WePlayCiv go down, honestly.
Happened once or twice, but yeah, it's pretty rare. I mean, we don't tax the server in any way. I mean, we have a pretty big, fast, powerful server. We use maybe 10% of it. So, pretty easy to run the site and runs itself almost. And yeah, I mean, donations are very, very important for us. We would not be able to run the site without the donations of something like 70% of our income. The rest comes from various contracts and ads and stuff. Yeah, it's entirely kept alive by the donations by the fans, and those are definitely very important for us.
How do you position yourself in the Civ community to distinguish yourself, say, at Bulletin or Civilization Fanatic Center?
We just want to be a relaxed place where people can hang out and have some fun. I mean, CFC is just a very big community. It's easy to get lost there. There's a lot of people. And as a result of that, there's a pretty, harsh moderation policy, I would say. They have to have a lot of troublemakers there. Just a lot of, it's difficult to keep a large community like that in check. And there's quite a few people that just don't feel comfortable with that. And we want to be an alternative to that. Don't really see us, as directly competing with Apollotan. To be honest, I'm not really sure what Apollotan is doing at the moment. I don't keep a close eye on that. We just want to provide a nice, healthy atmosphere. Just, get rid of all the problems that you have a big site with CFC and had some problems with Apollotan. Both, technical, of course, it's a pain in the ass to maintain, as, you yourself will know that. And, there's some issues. And there's some issues in the community we weren't particularly happy with some of the atmosphere there. We don't really feel very welcome. So that's why we started our own site and we're doing our own thing and not really paying too much attention to politics, to be perfectly honest.
What can you tell us about what we can look forward to on WePlayCiv in 2012?
That's a very good question.
So do we still have to sign like a non-disclosure agreement? Do we have to listening to the episode to sign one before you can tell us? Is that what you mean?
It's got to be secret.
Exactly.
It's classified information.
If I tell you, I have to kill you. So. It really depends on people volunteering their time. So we always have like 20 great ideas of things that I want to do with the Civ site. I mean, what's the case when I worked for Apollo, and it's still the case now. The only problem is I don't have the time to do most of those things. Hopefully I can find some people who will help me with other than that. A lot of ideas just fall by the wayside. Personally, I actually want to focus a lot more on modding myself, so I'm really going to let the staff that we hired see what they can do. And just keep an eye on things, make sure things keep running smoothly, but focus a little more time on other things myself.
Well, one thing I do like about WePlayCiv compared to other Civilization fan sites is that there is a little bit more focus on games that are not Civ. Mostly
even
other Civ Meier games. Yeah, even though it's WePlayCiv. WePlayCiv and other things.
Exactly.
And, so I've taken a look at the, other games forums, from time to time. I guess, since it's a newer site, there's more coverage of Civilization 4 and 5. I don't think a lot of people are playing 1, 2, and 3, that are on WePlayCiv.
Exactly,
yeah.
But we have pretty much, I think, most, if not almost all of the Alpha Centauri community. That's a very big community for us. It's bigger than Civ 4 and 5 combined. And yeah, I mean, we feel like we're all adult gamers. We don't play just Civ. So we have a very active indie game. Well, not very active indie games. We have an indie games forum and see some discussion and a big other games community. So people can share the other games that they're playing as well. So I feel like the world is more than Civ alone.
Yeah, it looks like most of the activity on Civ 4 is a lot of PBEM games. And then they've also got, there was a Polycast episode on the Courts of Candelabre game on there that you can get from the WePlayCiv site. And then, yeah, as you said, Alpha Centauri is pretty big, and it's not so much modding focus as CFC seems to be, at least from my perspective, because that's where I hang out. There's a lot more relaxed discussion about the game. I don't see nearly as much ego, I guess you'd say, throwing up on here, and there's a lot less random, simple questions being repeated over and over and over.
Exactly. Those are some of the problems you inevitably get with big sites, and in Polygon, some of them from back in the days when they were the biggest site, really don't feel like we want to ever become a site like that. So we're quite happy to be a small site, but it's just a very relaxed atmosphere. And we do host a bunch of small other projects that we feel like should be supported, like Gods of Conobre, the Skazaf, which is an indie game by Kenneth Furlett, was also a modcast host. And we hosted the Strategy Station, or at least the forums for it, which is Soren Jones' project. So basically a bunch of indie projects, if we like them, we support them. They don't even necessarily have to be very much like them, as long as there's at least somewhat strategy-like.
Any last words there, Water, for as far as We Play Civ in terms of what you would recommend new users do when they first arrive, where they should go?
Donate.
Give us your monies, is that what you're saying?
Exactly, yes.
Show him the shinies.
No, yeah, I mean, we like new users. It's not like we like to be small, but we can always use a few more people. So if people like a relaxed atmosphere, want maybe a little break from CFC, not that I visit CFC myself quite often. It's a great site for the things that it's great for, but there are also things that it's not so great for because it's so massive. So it's a nice alternative, and there's no reason you can't visit only one CFC site. So give us a try.
Call in today. In North America, the number is 301-637-7659.
That's 301-637-POLY.
In Europe, 44-121-288-7659. That's 44-121-288-POLY.
You can Skype us at The Polycast or email us at thepolycast@gmail.com.
The only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about.
For more information on Polycast,
our sibling shows Modcast and Revcast,
or about Polycast in general,
log on to the series' official website at thepolycast.net.
We would like, I think, I did the introduction to the show. I know Mackie wants to say something anyway as part of it.
Well, somebody else can do the outro thing, but I and two or three of the other regular kind of guest co-hosts that come on, James Robertson and Michael Lucas Smith and Alpha Shard, are doing another little podcast about Skyrim. It's more of a gameplay type of thing, and yeah, there's some spoilers in there if you listen, but since it only came out Friday, we're not that far in, so if you come in now, you can hear it. It's called Thumcast. Thumcast. I keep mispronouncing that word, but we are on iTunes, so Dan can put a link, right?
Yes, I can. I didn't say I would, but yes, I would.
Most would, thanks.
Pretty please with sugar on top. I'm asking that.
Is it shiny?
Oh, don't start singing the sugar song again.
I actually didn't start I asked if it was shiny. I was moving on from the sugar.
Oh, who whistled that?
I think it was Phil.
Wait, what?
Even if it wasn't, Phil will take the blame because he likes this thing.
I admit nothing in either direction.
But you don't deny anything either, so yeah.
I'm pleading the fifth. That's all there is to it.
This podcast does not recognize national constitutions, so that doesn't work.
It's an international podcast, it doesn't count.
Yeah.
Too bad. I'm pleading the fifth anyway. I didn't say which constitution I was using. My words are backed by nuclear weapons, after all.
So this has been Polycast 135. We have been joined today by our regular co-hosts, Dan Q.
One day with technical difficulties makes for a very sad face.
Makalua.
It's caffeine time. Mm-hmm.
The me and team.
Fair or not, nukes are the greatest.
And myself and our two guest co-hosts, Lucutus.
As always, Pepcak.
And Zian Wolf.
Down with currency.
Yes.
Have a good day, everyone.
Record date November 12th, 2011. Civilization 4, 5, and World Sound Clips. Copyright Take-Two Interactive. Copyright Civilized Communication at civcom.net.